Welcome to 7 Billion. It's getting crowded in here. Natasha Mitchell coming to you from the Wheeler Centre in Melbourne with a forum for ABC Radio National's special population weekend. We're calling it Beyond 7 Billion.
I don't want to live in an urban village. I get more social validation, connection, if you like, through my workplace. And then when I want to go home to the suburbs, I simply want to go to sleep. I don't want to chat with my neighbour. I don't want to chat over the fence. I've chatted at work. I just want to go home. And I don't want the butcher to know me. I don't want to know the butcher. This is my concept in the 21st century.
You asocial creature.
No. This is 21st century thinking.
The world's population was 5 billion. End of this month, it will be 7 billion. It's an increase of 2 billion people in the space of a short time. What we got to focus on is creating greener, more healthy living environment so that everyone can actually live more comfortably.
Sure, I agree that Australians have become very, very heavily invested in suburbia. I'd say over-invested, because I think that these things can change, and indeed they have to change, because low-density suburbia that cannot support frequent public transport simply has no future in a low-carbon world.
Community is something that forms on its own from the grassroots up. Whilst a number of developers, particularly recently, have, you know, I guess sold the idea of, you know, we're creating a community out here in Wallen, for want of a better place. And so when you come to our community, you're joining something. Really often what happens is that until people live there, there is no sense of community until they develop it themselves.
We're taking over All in the Mind and the Philosopher's Zone today to consider the arrival of the 7 billionth person on the planet this month. That's according to the UN. What a thought. In 2008, for the first time in human history, more of us lived in cities than in the rural areas of the world. In 2050, when 9 billion of us are expected on the planet, a staggering 70% will probably be living in urban areas. So for the Australian psyche, moulded by this mythology of the wide brown land and the quarter acre block and the carport and the garden shed and the barbecue area and the back fence, what will this mean for how we live, for how we relate to each other, for how we feel and think about ourselves? Now, we're not going to wage the population debate here today, though you might want to pick up on that. Instead, we're going in search of the soul in urban sprawl and in our cities. Our panel is well-known demographer, future forecaster and trend interrogator Bernard Salt. He's with KPMG and his popular books include The Big Shift, The Big Tilt and The Big Picture. As a community psychologist, Helen Kilmeyer has studied life in high-rise communities. Now she's doing her PhD comparing people living in inner, outer and outer Melbourne and their sense of place. She's the General Manager of Community Services for Interact Australia. Senwei Tan is the founder and CEO of Green World City Organisation, a sustainable cities consultancy whose clients include the Chinese government and the UN Habitat's World Urban Campaign. And Kim Dovey is Professor of Architecture and Urban Design at the University of Melbourne. His books include Becoming Places, Urbanism, Architecture, Identity, Power, and Fluid City, Transforming Melbourne's Urban Waterfront.
You're all city dwellers, and so I'd love to get your sense of what you love about being an urban dweller, and a city dweller. Kim?
Look, I think this story about the planet becoming more urban, becoming more than half urban, is a good story. I think that this is going to be the way in which we solve many of the major problems of the planet. And the two big ones, the looming ones, are global poverty and climate change. I think that learning how to live in cities, learning how to live more sustainably, more effectively, at higher densities in cities, is it's going to be the big success story of this century. So I'm actually very positive about cities. I think urban living is fantastic. And what's most fantastic about it is that cities are the great engines of change. They're the spatial machines almost that bump us into each other and into new ideas and new kinds of people and new kinds of new ways of living, more effective ways of living. So I'm not usually seen as an out-and-out optimist in this way, but I do think that this urbanisation of the planet is a good news story. And if there is anyone out there who's worried about population growth, the move to cities is one of the great antidotes to overpopulation.
Helen, what about you?
Well, I enjoy many of the aspects of living in the city in a similar way to Kim, in that I find that the city is an exciting place to live. It's a place where there are ideas and creativity. There's always something going on. I think our cities are changing, and they're changing rapidly, perhaps more rapidly in the here and now than they have in the past. And for me personally, I did what a lot of people do. I left home. I lived in a suburban environment. I moved all over the place. I rented for many years. But when it came to purchasing a home, I basically purchased something as close to where I used to live as possible, which I found quite interesting because when I was young, all I wanted to do was get away from there and feel free from, you know, the bounds of that community. When I decided to purchase, I felt like I wanted to return to a community where I had a sense of my own place.
What was pulling you back?
History, memory, the known, and I'd certainly lived in lots of unknown places just during the interim. But I also purchased something for me that had a very large backyard that I've transformed for myself into a place of reflection. Mm. And that was what I was looking for in addition to the location.
Okay, interesting. Bernard, how about you? You're very much an urban dweller.
Yes, I am an urban dweller, but I was raised in a small country town in Victoria, so I have a good appreciation, I think, of rural life. But for me personally, I think that that cities offer opportunity. Melbourne at 4 million, for example, is a global city. Sydney at 4 million is a global city. And the opportunities that are attached to those cities are global. You can work for a corporation that can take you anywhere in the world if you live in Melbourne, if you live in Sydney. And I think that's an enormously attractive proposition, particularly to young people today. If you look at the demographics of Australia over, say, the last generation or so, whereas in the 1960s, young people would remain in the country town that I was born in country Victoria, and work on a farm or work in a shop or whatever. Today you can see the demographics clearly, an outflow of young people from 18 through to 24 out of there into the city for job opportunities, education, training, and the frisson, if you like, that you get from 4 million people clustered together. Sure, we can make these things work better, but there is an argument that there is more opportunity. I think the American academic Richard Florida put his finger on this 10 years ago with his book The Rise of the Creative Class, which argued that because of density, there was greater opportunity, greater creativity associated with communities. I suspect, though, that if this forum was being held in Byron Bay, there would be a very different view. Mm-hmm. Now, I think we need to differentiate between metropolitan areas and rural and remote Australia. There's another type of Australia, which is the lifestyle areas of the coast and tree change areas, which are really almost extensions of capital city thinking and values.
And that's what you documented in The Big Shift.
That's exactly
the
right.
The big move of
exactly.
The baby boomers to the coastal areas.
That's right. I actually see that as an extension of the city. The sort of people that you see in Byron Bay or Mornington Peninsula, Bellarine Peninsula, or up the coast, down the coast, outside Queensland, or Central Coast in New South Wales, are really big city people with big city values. But you don't see those values, those people, those demographics, if you like, west of the Great Divide. If you look at the demographics of Australia, what you would say is we cannot stand the remote areas of Australia. We're leaving those areas, and to the extent that we're now flying in, flying out. We want to live in the cities, and there is now a weekly flight from Karratha to Melbourne. for miners. We don't want to live in Karratha. We'd much rather live in Melbourne. That's what the demographics are actually saying at the moment.
Senway, what about yourself? You've actually visited hundreds of cities around the world.
Yes.
You live in Sydney. What draws you to the city personally?
I think city answers a lot of questions and a lot of issues that we have. Urbanisation, whether we like it or not, the world is becoming urbanised. Let's not forget, I mean, in 1987, the world's population was 5 billion. End of this month, it will be 7 billion. It's an increase of 2 billion people in a space of a short time. What we got to focus on is basically how can we address all these issues. So what we want to do is focus on creating greener, more healthy living environment so that everyone can actually live more comfortably.
Helen, we have a tendency to pathologise cities, don't we? I mean, they are the reason for so many ills. And certainly, if we look at our mental health and well-being, levels of anxiety, levels of depression, of schizophrenia, of a whole range of different mental afflictions, are actually much higher in cities. Why is that? We've sung the praises of cities, but there are some pathologies associated with cities as well, and high-density living.
In part, that people need to have a choice, and many people don't have choice about where they're able to live and what they're able to afford. And so what I found is that often people living in public housing, in particular high-rise public housing, as you mentioned earlier, people there are often very isolated and they're living in a very high-density situation. But it's a situation that can come with a number of social issues attached to it around fear, whether it's perception or reality, incivilities, use of substances, etc., that creates a tension for those people living in those environments where they feel often very attached to their own home, their own flat, where they have some influence and some control, and they feel very attached to the amenities which surround their community, such as hospitals, places to shop, libraries, etc. But the space in between is a space where many people consider that they aren't safe. And so the navigation through that space can be quite lead to some trauma for some people and lead to severe isolation about them shutting themselves away from that in order to feel safe and secure.
It's one of the great ironies, isn't it, that we can feel profoundly lonely in a crowd. So high density living isn't going to necessarily make us feel like we've got company.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't. I actually asked people living in high-rise public housing, I was very interested in where they thought their neighbours were. I expected, I guess, for people to say, oh, you know, that this floor, you know, my neighbours are here. But people actually said my neighbours are those people, and those people. They're the people that have a direct influence.
I actually argue that the concept of neighbourhood has shifted. If you go back a generation, people used to hang over the back fence and chat with the neighbour. Whereas today, I think you are much more likely to hang over the office partition and chat with your neighbour. You're getting the sort of relationship that you used to get from your neighbour. You're getting that from your workmate. And so this leads to my argument that the neighbourhood is not necessarily a geography out in the burbs. It's more of a virtual space that I mix with my workmates. I'll go to restaurants or whatever with my... That is the new neighbourhood, not necessarily the suburb. It's almost like a 20th century notion. The concept of the neighbourhood.
Over the back fence.
Over the back
or,
fence, yeah.
Or we have virtual neighbourhoods, don't we?
Well, we do. Virtual neighbourhoods and virtual groups, friends, tribes, all of that. All about now being recast, I think, in the 21st century.
Kim, I was struck in some of your writing, the term urban actually comes from Latin for, is it urbanus?
Yeah.
Which actually means courteous and polite. Which I thought many urban contexts are sort of far from courteous and polite. Well, they're actually quite rude and
the urban condition
horrendous.
Is one where we have to develop codes of conduct where we respect difference, where we continuously encounter people who have different views to us, people we may not agree with, who may be our neighbours but may not be our friends. That's the urban condition. And so we develop codes of courtesy, of conduct, which are civilised, and that's a part of what cities do, I think. I just wanted to come back to one of these points too about crowding and this capacity to be isolated. It is an irony that you can be isolated in the highest density environments. Crowding is one of those strange two-sided terms. I mean, we've got a pretty good crowd here tonight, but You know, when you say a good crowd, that stands in contrast, I'm sorry, to what you might regard as feeling crowded. I don't think anyone in here tonight feels crowded. You call this a good crowd because it's full and so on. It may well be that when the event finishes and everyone wants to squeeze out through the one door, they're going to feel crowded. So this thing about density is very, very psychological and very time-dependent as well as spatially dependent. You know, that you can have a really good crowd, you can have 100 people in your house and you call it a good crowd. If you had to live there, you might call it crowded. So what we call crowding and the kind of stress and the negative effects of that often have to do with internal conditions, with the overcrowding of internal space. And in my understanding, there's no real evidence at all of overcrowding in public space having any deleterious effect whatever.
Oh, that's really interesting, because this seems to me to be very much a state of mind thing. Senwei, you spend a lot of time in the megacities of the world where crowding is overwhelming for those of us who, yes, you know, live in the burbs. Mm. Is it a state of mind?
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, you know, some countries in the world, they've been living in very high density for generations. And, it really is in the state of mind and the sense of happiness people feel actually based on your sense of control. Yeah. If you have more sense of control over what you're doing, generally you feel happier. And if you have less sense of control, whether you live out in the suburbs or wherever, you'll actually feel less happy.
What sort of control, though? I mean, let's take one of those massive, crowded megapolises that you spend time in.
Yes.
Can people have a sense of control? How do they institute that sense of control?
Yes and no, I suppose. Quite a few things we can't control, obviously. A lot of people living, for example, in big cities like Shanghai and so forth, well, I mean, the quality of air, quality of water, something you can't really control. But in terms of who you associate with, where you go, certainly you can control that.
Interesting. Bernard, you think that that inner city living will never quite do it for Australians the way nature strips do.
No, that's right. I've got a soft spot for the burbs. Look, I think Australian cities can be improved, but this idea that we're all going to dense up and live in high-rise apartments, no, certainly some people will, but we have a cultural attachment to suburbia and no place more so than Melbourne. We in Melbourne invented the quarter-acre block and the three-bedroom brick veneer, and we're very proud of it. Barry Humphries came and celebrated suburbia. It's the first real Australian iconography, if you like, coming out of Melbourne suburbia. Neighbours is an invention of Melbourne, filmed in Pinoak Crescent, South Vermont, projected Melbourne suburbia to the world for 30 years, showcasing our lifestyle.
Excellent.
And, of course, it had incredible resonance in the UK. And then Kath and Kim, a recent incarnation, if you like, of exactly the same thing.
But these
celebrating
are lampooning suburbia.
Sorry?
They're lampooning suburbia.
Well,
Humphreys.
Maybe
Humphreys,
lampooning or celebrating. I don't think it's actually mean.
Humphreys,
I don't think
comes
it's a negative.
He comes back to defend Melbourne because he needs it in order to continue his career.
he's been incredibly successful. I think, yes, there is a little edge to it, but I think that's the nature of humour. But I also think it's a celebration.
It doesn't mean it's sustainable. If the suburbs can't sustain frequent public
transport, then they really don't have a future.
Don't
disagree with that. We're talking about the cultural affinity that Melburnians and Australians feel for suburbia.
But that's
been
changed.
My point is that it's so strong. It's been there for 50, 60 years, probably 100 years or so. It's not going to change easily. I agree that it needs to change, but it's like turning a supertanker. Don't expect it to turn quickly.
But
it might take 20 or 30 years to get the level of density that you're actually pursuing.
When you contrast it with high-rise, I think you drop into the kind of polarisation that's done so much damage to the debate in Australia. The best forms of high density are not high-rise. And this notion that if you abandon the suburbs, then we're all going to live in high-rise is complete nonsense. All of the best urban design schemes for higher density living are not simply high-rise towers dotting the landscape. They tend to be medium density. They use different housing types. And indeed, many of the ones that haven't hardly been tried in Melbourne are between about five and eight stories high, the kind of housing we simply don't build here because the industry's not geared for it.
I don't have a problem with that, and I think that is certainly the way that Melbourne and Sydney and other cities will evolve. That is the densification, particularly of transportation corridors, railway stations and so forth, 3, 5, 7 or 8 stories out in the burbs. But it's that broad swathe of suburbia that fits in between those corridors that I think hold a culture, a value, if you like, that goes to the heart of Australian values, that you can't, it's going
what,
to be difficult
to
change.
What does that mean, Bernard? Goes to the heart of Australian values. Values change with generations.
Well, they do, but why are we growing places like on the edge of Melbourne, this idea of McMansions, if you like? On the one hand, we say, yes, we need to sensible, you know, 4, 5, 6, 7-storey developments or high-rise, and yet there is a mass market out there that still wants that. And it's almost like this conflict. You've got two tribes inhabiting our capital cities.
And that's about affordability as well, and also preference.
How do you know the market wants that, if that's all that the market has ever force-fed?
Well, look, if the market...
I mean, the developers sit in the minister's office, they say, let's extend the growth boundary again, we'll have lots of cheap agricultural land out on the urban fringe, and we just go through another round of exactly the same thing, and then everyone says, well, that's what the market wants.
So, but if the market wanted that, then profit-driven developers would deliver that. It's as simple as that. Why would they not pursue the path of least resistance to nose profit? If that's what the majority want, then that's it. My point is, I'd love to see that, very happy to see that. But there is still this resonance, if you like, of suburbia that strikes a chord with middle metropolitan Australia.
Is that not the great Australian dream?
It has been the great Australian dream, it needs to change, and it has changed dramatically.
You think that urban densification has become something of a doctrine. Just briefly, why?
I'm not against densification at all. I'm a supporter of a diversity of housing across capital cities. And I think most modern town planning thinking is there should be a diversity of housing options, low density, medium density, high density. And it's a question of how you can deliver all of those combinations, if you like, in our capital cities. So you have densification within a 10-15k radius, you have densification along transportation railway corridors, but you also have sensibly planned, master planned transportation infrastructure delivered low density suburban areas as well to meet the demand as required by some Australians.
This is 7 billion. It's getting crowded in here. Coming to you from the Wheeler Centre in Melbourne for Radio National's special Population Weekend, we're searching for the soul in urban sprawl. Natasha Mitchell with you. And with demographer Bernard Salt, community psychologist Helen Kilmeyer, architect, professor and urban designer Kim Dovey, and sustainable cities consultant Senwei Tan.
Senwei, is this a rather indulgent conversation that we're having here as Australians with all this space to indulge ourselves in? In the countries that you're working in and consulting to, space is not even a luxury they can even contemplate.
Yes, in some countries you're right. We represent, for example, 0.3% of the world's population. In some countries like China and India, they've got to absorb another, for example, China. China's going to absorb another 350 to maybe half a billion people in the next 20, 25 years. They've already absorbed about 300 million of people coming into the urban areas. So that calls for a lot more urbanization, a lot more use of resources, obviously, in terms of environmental pollution and all these other issues that we are faced with. We realize it's happening. Whether we like it or not, it's happening. What we're trying to do is try to make it a friendlier process by providing cost-effective solutions. You know, what we do is pretty simple. We find the best experts we can find around the world and introduce them to government authorities who are looking for these solutions.
So you're working with governments of some of these countries, like China,
yes,
to work out, okay, if you're going to have all these people, if we're going to densify and build new cities as China is right across the country. I've been there briefly and I was sort of staggered by it.
And it's happening, yes.
But so how do you approach the conversation with them? Is it even possible to have a sustainable approach to building cities that are rising up so fast?
Yes and no. Yes, you're going to cause environmental damage if you are urbanizing, you know, like building cities. You are going to cause quite a bit of damage. But you can actually do it in a friendlier way. and a less damaging way. So that's what we're just trying to do. We're providing solutions and showing better ways of doing things.
So around wastewater, around...
In terms of master planning, for example, better way of master planning cities, in terms of different introducing them to different engineering solutions, in terms of recycling, in terms of wastewater management and things like that.
Helen Kilmeyer, Senway has just talked about friendly places and more friendly processes. And you're interested, as you are, Kim, in what makes a space a place. Now, what's the distinction you're getting at there, and why is it so important in this conversation about rapid population growth?
It's been said that place is space filled up by people's, I guess, emotional investment, by the bonds that people form, that a space is a space until such time as somebody invests within that space, and then it can become a place. My interest is in place attachment and how people form effective bonds with their communities, their homes, and whether or not there's any overlap with sense of community.
What does it mean to be attached to a place, do you think? And why is it important to our well-being, our sense of well-being?
What I found with people who have a high attachment to place, it's about their emotional investment in the place. And so that place for them is frequently filled with memories. One woman said to me, this is where my daughter left for her wedding. You know, this place is full for me of memories and history and good times and bad times, but this is where I've, you know, lived out my life. And so this was a woman who was actually living, I think, on the 18th floor of a high-rise public housing building. And I said to her, you know, what is it like, you know, living up here? And she said, oh, this isn't my home. I said, oh, I'm sorry, where's your home? She said, I'm down on the fifth floor. And so for me it was about saying, well, you know, does that make a difference? And for her it was saying, well, the fifth floor is my home and the 18th floor is where I've been temporarily relocated while they're renovating it. So place is a particularly important construct, I think, for people and is very tied up with their emotional affect and the way that they feel about the place. Many places also have a negative connotation, and people can feel attached to a place that for them may have a negative feeling. It could be that people still visit the graves of people who are passed on, and that may not be a pleasant memory, but there's a strong attachment to the place where that event, you know, took place, where that person's located. So there's a shadow side to place attachment. People still go and visit the Holocaust, with the sites of the Holocaust and Auschwitz, etc. And those places have no good memories for people, and yet they're a place
they're
where
attached.
Many people feel a very strong attachment.
Which is interesting. If we think about new urban developments rising up from the dust in Australia to accommodate a growing population in urban centres, this question of just being able to kind of land community in a place... So you're doing some... Part of your PhD is involved in the Docklands in Victoria, which is emblematic of a lot of similar developments around Australia, Darling Harbour in Sydney and others in Perth and Brisbane as well. And yet it's not straightforward. You just can't sort of... It's like the sea monkey phenomena, isn't it? I think someone described it. You can't just have a little bunch of crystals and add a bit of water and there you've got community.
That's right. Community is something that forms on its own from the grassroots up. Whilst a number of developers, particularly recently, have, you know, I guess, sold the idea of, you know, we're creating a community out here in Wallen, for want of a better place. And so when you come to our community, you're joining something. Really often what happens is that until people live there, there is no sense of community until they develop it themselves. So there's often not enough infrastructure, and the infrastructure usually catches up with the population moving in rather than the other way around. So people create their own sense of community, whatever that may be. And for people now, it can be virtual. A lot of people are showing me that their, you know, Facebook is one of their strongest senses of community, and that's a community in virtual land.
So they're inside their apartment, inside an urban desert, surrounded by concrete, having a great old time. Yeah. Bernard.
One of the very fashionable ideas, I think, for about the last 20 years in town planning has been the notion of urban villages. If you really want to...
Now that really gets your goat.
If you really want to turn on a town planner, you say urban village, or put the word sustainable urban village, and they just They just love it, just love it. The city of Sydney is a good example of this. Clover Moore has a strategic plan for turning the city of Sydney, that is the metropolitan, the municipality of Sydney, into urban villages. So you have Ultimo and Pyrmont and Surry Hills and Paddington and Darling Harbour, whatever it is.
What is an urban village? Is it
this is the point. It's like an urban village, is like an idea where you know your neighbour and you chat across the road and you're feeling connected and you know the butcher and the butcher knows you. I don't want to live in an urban village. This is my point about neighbourhood. I get more social validation, connection, if you like, through my workplace. And then when I want to go home to the suburbs, I simply want to go to sleep. I don't want to chat with my neighbour. I don't want to chat over the fence. I've chatted at work. I just want to go home. And I don't want the butcher to know me. I don't want to know the butcher. This is my concept in the 21st century.
You asocial creature.
No, this is my mind. This is 21st century thinking. That if the nature of neighbourhood has changed, I'm getting social connection, validation, but it's just different. And if we are going to have a truly diverse metropolitan area, then there should be a place in a metropolitan area for bizarre people like me.
Who don't want to be part of the community.
That, you know, you're involved in work, then you come home, and then you get, you know, everyone else can have community, but...
Kim, how do you think about this? I mean, you're interested in healthy places, and healthy isn't about, you know, what makes us sick and what makes us well. It's actually about a sense of community.
Good cities have got plenty of room for people like Bernard, but also lots of others. I think most people, including Bernard probably, invest their sense of identity in places, in cities, in places at every level. We invested in Australia, we invested in Melbourne, we invested in particular neighbourhoods within that. Sometimes I think it becomes a kind of a fetish. The research I've been doing on urban character, one of the things it revealed was, and this is based in Melbourne, but I think it's true elsewhere as well, that when you scratch this question of urban or neighbourhood character, what you find is something really quite fluid, and that in some neighbourhoods it means it's a kind of a protected, inward-looking sense of this place must not change because we're very invested in keeping it exactly the way it is, perhaps for heritage reasons in some cases. In other cases, though, there are very, very different kinds of identification with place. Some suburbs are defended because of their mix. Because they're diverse, and that it's seen that new developments, perhaps bulky developments, perhaps overdevelopment, what's seen as overdevelopment, is actually threatening the very diversity and mix of that neighbourhood rather than the purity of it. So place can mean many things, and it can change. Sure, I agree with Bernard that Australians have become very, very heavily invested in suburbia. I'd say over-invested, because I think that these things can change, and indeed they have to change, because low-density suburbia that cannot support frequent public transport simply has no future in a low-carbon world. You cannot reconcile that. So that the Australian suburbs, and we have so much suburbia, I see no reason in trying to produce more of it. What I see the real task is to produce transit-oriented development that will bring walkable access to good public transport, frequent public transport. That means no timetable. It means you turn up and the transport turns up.
Just pick up on that point, new public transport. I agree with that. It would be fantastic to actually have railway lines out to Werribee. The North West Railway Link in Sydney is a good example. South West down to Bringelly would be terrific.
But whose houses are going to go to accommodate it?
It's how much does it cost? It's $5 billion to run a 47-kilometre railway line from Southern Cross Railway Station in Melbourne to Windervale. That's 100... What's a 47 into 5 billion, whatever that cost
is. But what is the cost of not having that care?
Well, no, there's another way. There's another way. Everyone says, well, let's get public transport. Yep, that's terrific. We can afford it. I agree with that. There is another way you can do this that meets our carbon footprint, and that is the decentralisation of jobs. Why are we taking people from Cranbourne, from Penrith, from Caboolture into the CBD every day to a job? Isn't it easier to take the job to the person? So let's take jobs out of the CBD and seed them in Werribee, in Castle Hill, in Mount Gravatt, in Joondalup, in Perth, so that people can ride to work. You then it's the Canberra model, if you like, containerisation of the city. One approach is to have really, really expensive public transport. Yep, terrific, great. Another thing is to provide incentives, town planning incentives, whatever incentives, to decentralise jobs. There's 250,000 jobs in the centre of Melbourne. Let's take 80,000 and seed them around the metropolitan area so that you're actually reducing the carbon footprint. People live, work, play, recreate, go to work, go to hospital, go to university, all within the same area. That, to me, is a better model for the future.
Kim, what's your thought about that redistribution?
Oh, it's obvious. Yeah, no, I agree with that. But I don't think it works without good public transport. Public transport is cheap. This notion of can we afford public transport, people don't seem to say that when they're talking about roads, the upkeep of roads and the construction of new roads. We've got to stop servicing the car. I mean, a large piece of the problem with making cities work better is to get the kind of network flows, the distributed network flows. That's how cities work. They work, they're growth engines, and that they work by connecting people to each other and to ideas and to products and so on, and that they have to flow. And the car network and the extent to which parking keeps us apart from each other has become completely out of control. Kim, we have to turn that around.
Kim, in some of your work, you've looked at groups who have opposed urban densification. What are the major concerns about densifying our cities? And I guess implicit in this, we're assuming that population is going to grow, and I'm sure that's going to come up with audience discussion and questions. But if we assume that population is going to grow, as problematic as that is for some people, what are the concerns about densification?
I think it presses some buttons that are probably unnecessarily in many cases, that people see it as being overwhelmed. They see their own sense of worth and of power and of identity being overwhelmed by high-rise buildings, by too many people and so on. So that's a kind of a dystopian psychology almost.
Is it an aesthetic thing as well?
I think in part that, but I also think that there's a complete lack of vision. We haven't put our design imagination to work enough in this country to produce the kind of visions of urban futures that can catch the public imagination and bring them with us. Because I do think that when the planning is done well and people feel that they're still in charge of their future, they will accept much, much more change than is usually regarded to be the case, where people are simply forming resident groups and digging their heels in and saying, not in my backyard. I think there's a lot of examples where one of my PhD students did a case study, which was in Canada, where the planning was done particularly well, and an entire community went through a major intensification process around a railway line, and they argued at the end that the urban character had been preserved, and yet there'd been massive, massive physical changes. What they were really saying was that the character and identity of the community that they really cared about was primarily social, and that it was quite possible then to bring in massive changes that, as long as that sense of social identity and community were somehow respected through that process.
Helen Kilmeyer, you've been involved in quite a lot of community-type consultations, haven't you, in local government situations. What makes the difference?
One of the things I used to say to some of the councils that I worked in was, do you want a thorough process or do you want a quick process? Do you want people to really come on board? Do you really want to consult with the communities? And if so, it's going to take this much time to do that and to provide people with a real opportunity to have some input.
But sometimes consultation around new developments can just be, we'll just do that, we'll make them all feel good. And in fact, in the end, people feel like they've got no power. Mm. The development still happens, or a version of it, or the tree comes down, or, you know, is it a sort of hopeless battle, despite what councils say?
I actually think that the community always has much more power than it thinks it does. And should it choose to mobilise that power, it can be an amazing force to be reckoned with. However, it requires cooperation and a certain level of cohesion for that to happen. But I've seen that happen where decisions have been overturned. Then, of course, they go to VCAT and that's a whole other story. But at the
I think there are some very powerful examples of where the community has blocked projects or developments. A good example of that is in Perth with the Cottesloe Beach proposal to have high-rise on the beach, and the locals have decided no, and that's blocked that project. Camberwell here in Melbourne is another example where that has been blocked. So there are key sites, and I suppose there might be other examples
but
where it might have gone the other way.
But the comeback to some of those campaigns might be, well, look, the population's growing. We have to share the load here. Development is inevitable.
But if the community, in a democratic community, if a majority of people say, no, we don't want that, then the system responds accordingly. So it's not as if the community does not have power. In fact, there are some great examples of where the community has had the authority and changed the outcome.
You have to distinguish between where that opposition is legitimate and where it isn't. So Camberwell, for instance, where there's a two-story hole in the ground that just crying out for redevelopment that is being resisted and was being resisted.
I actually agree with you on that.
Compared to doing high-rise development on the foreshore where you're casting the beach into shadow and so on. Yeah. So there are legitimate forms of resident resistance and there are some dubious ones.
I actually agree with you on that. On those specific, I don't like the word legitimate and illegitimate. If the majority of people say we don't want that, then that's legitimate in a democracy.
But the majority of people in Camberwell want to stop the railway station redevelopment? It doesn't seem to me that that's the end of the story at all. There's a larger public interest that's involved here.
Interesting. Senway, when does urbanisation fail? What are the catastrophic examples of urbanisation that you've witnessed?
You only need to travel to some cities. For example, I was in Mumbai, Bombay. From the port area to the airport takes about 2 hours. And all along the streets, you see slums. Hundreds of millions of people moving to cities around the world. I mean, this is just one example. And what do they end up with? Living in slums. But then again...
And that's the urban reality of the majority of cities,
yeah.
Really.
The only big example of somewhat success, I would say, is China. China has managed to absorb about 300 million odd people into the urban areas without the creation of massive slums that you see around the world.
How have they done that? Well, is that all about planning?
Some people argue that the slums in China are largely hidden.
Yeah, it's... I mean, there are slums, definitely, but a lot less than many other large cities around the world. But, I mean, one thing that I see that's positive is that the investment in renewable energies, for example. Because one thing that's important, to power cities around the world, we're absorbing a lot of people. We have to absorb a lot of people. We need to actually generate power from renewable energies.
I wonder, too, whether you... certainly when new high-rise... lots of the new high-rise developments go up in Australian cities now. I often think, what a missed opportunity. They could have made this an absolute showcase for renewables or good design or solar passive or, you know. Do you think that we are not taking all the opportunities that we could be?
I think so. I mean, we are blessed with abundant sun here. We've got a lot of land to put in wind turbine. For example, in the last 2 years in China has invested more in renewable energy than what we're producing annually in terms of electrical power output. So it's possible for us to actually be very close to 100% renewable.
That's one dream anyway for our world cities. 7 billion people are due to populate the planet this month, according to the UN. We're marking the occasion on ABC Radio National this weekend with lots of population discussion and debate. And we've taken over the All in the Mind and Philosopher's Zone slots with a forum considering the high-density life. Potentially great for our environment, right? Reducing our carbon footprint as we pack ourselves in like sardines. But what does it do to our heads and hearts? What sort of shift will it bring for the Australian psyche, moulded by the myth of the wide brown land and sharing a cup of sugar over the back fence with our neighbours? Let's come now to some of the questions from the audience at the Wheeler Centre in Melbourne.
I have to speak first because you've mentioned Camberwell so many times and I'm the one who led the battle there.
So for the national audience, Camberwell is a suburb about 15 kilometres out of town, out of the centre of Melbourne. A leafy suburb.
Which we are desperately trying to protect from high density. And we have lost our battle with Camberwell Station. VCAT overturned what the local people want. And so there will be a monstrous thing built there. We had planned, Mr. Dovey, we had planned with an architect and a landscape designer something excellent there, which we all wanted. And now instead we're going to have a high-rise horror, which they can't even sell off the plan at the moment because they're such little miniature apartments.
So can I put the question back to you, because we can't take on an entire complexity of an individual case. But what's the concern for you about a high rise?
We live in a heritage area and we have the right to protect a beautiful heritage area from overdevelopment. I want to ask Mr. Dovey how he thinks he's going to put high rise everywhere that he thinks that people aren't getting enough of. When I go to my old home in Jakarta a little while ago and I find that developers are selling things off the plan in Jakarta for Melbourne, because they can't sell off the plan here high-rise apartments.
All right. I think that was for you, Kim.
I'm actually not a fan of high-rise development particularly. I don't think, you know, 8 stories and 10 stories is particularly high-rise by global standards. I think it's relatively modest. I think that that's the kind of development that makes an awful lot of sense on the Camberwell Railway Station, which is the particular project in question. I can't see that that's a problem. I think that you have communities like the Camberwell community where there's quite a lot of people who are ageing and the kids leave home and they're rattling around in a large house on a large block, and the phenomenon which is known as ageing in place is where you try to create the kind of scaled down housing that enables a kind of a lifestyle for those people as the demography changes. And I think you're only adding variety to a place like Camberwell. It's interesting in that case, the research that we did on it was that back in the 1980s, the resident group did a study of that site and suggested that 8-storey development would be appropriate, no higher than 8 storeys. By 2002, there were people saying that 3 storeys is too much. So this isn't a good example of how ideology kind of takes over and people become more resistant to change rather than more open to a progressive city.
So next one, thank you, at the back.
Taking it to the global level, as I don't know if everyone knows, but Australia has one of the largest per capita carbon footprints in the world and ecological footprints. So this is a question to the whole panel. Do we have a moral obligation to actually address our footprint? And if the rest of the developing world wants to, you know, if they aspire to live how we do on our quarter acre block, we can't sustain that. So should we be providing, you know, a better example?
A question about our carbon footprint. A good one. I noticed that in Scientific American last month, they did an entire special on cities and the fact that they might be a solution to the problems of our age. Bernard, is this one of them?
I agree. It's not just the carbon footprint and all that goes with that. It's a question of inefficiency. The idea of living in the burbs and commuting into the CBD is a 20th century concept. It's a 19th century concept. The technology has simply changed from trams, trains to automobiles. The 21st century response to that is to take jobs to the people. Now, Kim has said, well, we need to be focusing on public transport or diverting funds away from highways or motorways or whatever. While we're waiting for the politicians to actually make that decision to redirect funds from motorways to railways, my idea of decentralising actively, proactively, decentralising jobs, I think, is the best way to achieve the reduction in the carbon footprint. And the best example of this has come out of Melbourne. About 4 years ago, the TAC, the Transport Accident Commission, was decentralised from Exhibition Street to Geelong. 770 jobs came out of the CBD and went to Geelong. Made not a jot of difference, really, to the CBD, but a big difference to Geelong. Let's not decentralise necessarily to Geelong, but to Werribee, to Broadmeadows, to Moonee Ponds, to Box Hill, to Moorabbin, and containerise the city. I think that would have a bigger impact on reducing our carbon footprint than a lot of other alternative strategies.
Senwe, are cities the solution to reducing our carbon footprint, or do they come with all their own baggage?
They're part of the solution. Another solution would be to adopt more green technologies in terms of green building technologies and looking for more cost-effective solutions, but always focusing on how to make it green, but also focusing on how to actually make it feasible, financially feasible for us. I think that's the key.
Do you find it hard to convince governments that it is going to be financially feasible? We were talking about public transport before, a huge capital investment needed in that sort of infrastructure, and people balk at that.
Things like this are always a challenge, obviously, but it's our role to keep on campaigning. For example, pretty soon we're going to be launching a Green Cities criteria, framework and a checklist. So it's very powerful and very significant because it will help authorities and decision-making people to look at something and say, OK, this is what we need to do. A simple checklist that anyone with reading age of 14 or above can understand. So it's feasible. It's very readable, but also something that we want to show people and also excite people about what's possible for the future, because we believe a future where people living in cities and around the world can have clean water, clean air. Our power will be powered by renewable energy, and our transport will be green.
We're a way
it's
off yet,
possible.
Aren't
the
we?
Knowledge is already out there. The knowledge is out there. What we need to do is just combine all the great knowledge we have around the world and focus on providing it and making it cost-effective.
Kim, do we have a moral responsibility to live in cities so as to reduce our carbon footprint, as the questioner asked?
I don't know if there's any moral responsibility to move to cities. There's certainly a moral responsibility to address the issues of both climate change and global poverty, and I think that they largely go together. So I do see a moral responsibility there, and I think particularly for any new city infrastructure that we're putting in, the moral responsibilities become quite high. We should remember that the major decisions we make about street networks, public transport and density have very, very long-term effects, much longer term than putting in place a policy which can be changed, much longer term than building a building which can be demolished. But once you put in place the basic infrastructure and you allow, say, a suburban development to develop at about 10 dwelling units a hectare, Australians will come, they'll put down their roots, and they will then defend that density almost forever. We often forget that the things that we value about cities have come about through a whole series of layers. There's a natural environment, then there's often an agricultural environment, then there's often the first form of urban layer, and that becomes a kind of a mature suburbia, and then we declare it finished. I don't think that that's valid. I think we've got to say that the suburbs are not yet finished, and that while they're not to be transformed, and in some cases are to be, the values there are to be preserved, we do have to fit them out with a far more sustainable infrastructure.
Let's come to another question if we can.
Yes, thank you, Julianne Bell. That's been some very interesting issues, but I want to raise another one. You all mention social contact, social cohesion. Not one of you except Helen has mentioned the importance of public open space. So I'd like you to comment, if you could, on the importance to people of open space.
Thank you. Helen, do you want to pick that up? Because certainly in some of the work that you've been doing of high-density communities, open space is an important part of this. It doesn't always feel safe, does it?
No, it doesn't always feel safe. And there's a big difference between the perception and the reality of that. But I guess the reality is if people feel unsafe, they feel unsafe. However, you're quite right. Healthy parks provide people with recreation opportunities, opportunities to spend time together as neighbours, as families. The openness of those areas, the bicycle tracks, the waterways that are attached to them have definitely been associated with healthier lifestyles and healthier living, and that livability of an area without open public space, livability declines enormously. So it's terribly important.
Kim, in terms of high-density environments, often we feel like if we put some white pebbles down and a few bits of strappy grass, but primarily concrete and asphalt, that's what we define as open space. But they're hot, alien sorts of environments sometimes, aren't they?
I think we can do better than that. I mean, I would just endorse the comment and say, and thank you for making it, because I think that the value of open space actually increases as density rises, as people have less access to a backyard or a balcony, then their need for that release becomes more important. And I think in some cases we've got some fabulous parks where there's perhaps not enough density around them. And I'm not suggesting we lose parkland. I'm simply suggesting that you can actually intensify around the public open space. It increases its value.
Well, on that note, can I thank Bernard Salt, Helen Kilmeyer, Kim Dovey, Senwei Tan, and thank you.
And our guests have been Senwei Tan, Helen Kilmeyer, Bernard Salt and Kim Dovey, and a packed house at the Wheeler Centre in Melbourne. Big thanks to their team. More details on the All in the Mind website about our guests, plus the transcript and the audio, abc.net.au/rn/allinthemind, where you can discuss the issues, offer an opinion, kick up a storm, expand the population debate. If you'd like to, we'd like you to. Look for Add Your Comment, and also head to the Radio National homepage for all the details of our special population weekend here on the network, abc.net.au/rn. Thanks today to Corin Podger for co-production and to Alex Stinson and Maria Tickle. I'm Natasha Mitchell. Catch you next week.
Hi, Fran Kelly here with some great news for our Canberra listeners. ABC Radio National is now a part of the digital radio trial in the national capital. Digital radio offers you more than easy tuning and clear reception. There's the five extra ABC digital stations, including Radio National, and our arts and features programs benefit from digital radio's improved sound quality. For details, go to abc.net.au/digitalradio.